Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening and welcome back to an adventure in history. We are once again so happy that you're joining us tonight, and I'm excited to talk with our guests.
We are. We went right to the source because we've talked about him and something he was involved in.
Yes.
But we realized maybe we should just have him come on.
It was just this little swim, this little swim across the mighty Columbia River. It's amazing. So we invited Dr. Paul Silka to join us. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome.
Thanks for fitting us in your busy schedule. This actually started like months ago to get on his calendar. So,
well, then we shouldn't squander any
time.
I know.
Let's go.
But I do need to say, you know, last week we didn't talk about it, but Talking Tombstones.
Yes.
Talking Tombstones 19. Thank you, Vancouver Granite Works, for sponsoring it. And Greenwood Cemetery. It's the fourth time we've been out there, privately owned. First time ever. We've had all kinds of different weather. We've hot. We've had rain. We've had nonstop rain. Never had a thunderstorm before.
Did you really have thunder?
Did.
Oh.
No lightning. Because we were like, if we see lightning, we got to call it. And the thunder, we heard in a distance. And then the rain cloud just went over pretty fast. But definitely hit the attendance a little bit. But by like 2:30, it was beautiful out.
And it's perfect. The perfect background for Talking Tombstones.
It was a little eerie to see the dark, dark clouds and hear thunder in the distance and look down at the Youngs River. So anyway, Talking Tombstones 19 in the can, done. Fantastic. Great event. Fantastic actors, as always.
Great. I got a word.
Got a word.
It's a verb.
Verb,
this is
you're bringing
a verb
back.
I am going to bring back. I will use this one. Honeyfuggle.
Honeyfuckle.
Fuggle.
Fuggle.
Yes.
Fuggle. Honeyfuggle.
Yes.
And it's a verb.
It is. It's a verb.
All right. Yep. I guess first so that I can appear a lot stupider than you are, though I don't think that we need that word to do that. But so I believe that that is a verb that means to go out and harvest honey.
Ooh. Okay. Nope. He's wrong. Do you have any guess?
I think it's a Valentine's Day word where you go and hug the one you love.
Ooh, he's closer.
I like
it's
that.
It's to compliment or flatter someone to get something you want.
Oh.
So I see where I could use this in my daily life with my children or my husband.
Yeah.
Right? Honeyfuggle. So.
All right. Use it in sentences, though. I want to hear you use it in a sentence.
Ben wanted to play a game, but he had to honeyfuggle his girlfriend first for TV time.
Okay.
See?
All right.
He had to compliment her to get something he wanted.
If you started using that, that might come back.
Honeyfuggle.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
And enunciate carefully.
Yes.
Yes, Mac. Thank you.
All right. It just sounded like a dirty word when I said it. I didn't actually say a dirty word.
Right. Yes.
All right. So the history highlights, these are things that happen tomorrow, November 4th, as always, icebreakers at work or conversation starters or bar trivia. November 4th, 1646, Massachusetts uses the death penalty for denying that the Holy Bible is God's word.
Massachusetts,
not exactly friendly to the religious freedom of people. 1845, the first nationally observed uniform election day in the United States. The first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. 1845.
Okay. We stuck with it.
We did.
Yeah. Okay.
I need to do a deeper dive. And before that.
Right,
was
when
it
did
just
they do it?
Like all crazy, each state deciding on their own, each county deciding on their own.
Oh, probably.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
But I love the first Tuesday after the first Monday.
But how many people do you run into that don't know when it is, when Election Day occurs? I mean, there's quite a few. Yeah. Dr. Silka's nodding. I mean,
I think most people just think it's like the first Tuesday in the month or something.
Right.
But, so.
Okay.
Okay. 1846. American inventor Benjamin Palmer from Meredith, New Hampshire, patents the artificial leg.
Ooh, that's...
Before that, we just had pirates with peg legs.
It's useful.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Good timing for the Civil War.
Yeah. See, that's what I was thinking, is 1846. What is prompting this? If you just told me to guess what year, I would have said 1864. Oh my gosh, we got all these guys, we've amputated legs and arms, and somebody's coming up with a way to make their lives a little better.
Yeah.
So 1846, I should do a deeper dive and find out what was going on in his life that he he patents this and he thinks there's a market for it. 1862, American inventor Richard Jordan Gatling patents the hand-cranked Gatling machine gun in Indianapolis. It was almost going to be my history highlight today, the thing that had the most important, but I did do a deeper dive to see if it was, in fact, the first machine gun, but it's not. Okay. There's actually some other people that are kind of working on it. His becomes the most popular.
Right. Yeah. So it has an impact for sure.
Yep. 1879, James Ritty patents, a lot of patents on this day. James Ritty patents the first cash register to combat stealing by bartenders in a saloon in Dayton, Ohio.
Oh, that's funny.
I like that one.
Saloon. Yeah. And it never happened again.
But yeah, we never had any employee theft after that. But I'm curious how he thinks the cash register is going to solve employee theft.
Right.
Are they not going into the cash register to make change?
Well, it's still a document. I mean, you have to kind of be good at math too, yeah, right?
Yeah. 1922. I was thinking about this one as well as the history highlight of the day. 1922, the entrance to King Tut's tomb is discovered.
Ooh.
Ooh.
That's a good one.
2008, Barack Obama elected as America's first black president.
Woohoo.
And actually, there's a lot of other presidents who are elected on this day in different years, but he's a little significant.
Yes.
But our history highlight of the day, the thing that I think had the most impact, and I'll be open to arguments from both of you on this one.
Okay.
1979, 500 Iranian students loyal to Ayatollah Khomeini seized the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, taking 90 hostages for 444 days.
Yeah.
And I would argue that it had a huge impact, but it's also, I think that's the moment in my life that I became more aware of the greater world and our role as a nation in it. Because I was just a kid, but I was seeing it on the news.
Right.
It did bring geopolitics right to the surface.
Yeah, it kind of, I mean, I always liked history, but it was all foreign and ancient. It wasn't modern. And to see it on the paper, and this was affecting our country, and my parents were watching it on the news and talking about it, and I'd never encountered that before. So
same.
Yeah. Well, and politics in Iran were so huge, yet it didn't come, you know, it didn't hit home until then either, right? Yeah. So, I mean, it was affecting us, but then to see that. Yeah.
So what I miss? Yep. Anything?
No, those were good. Yeah. You finally did it, Mac.
Well done.
Well done.
I'm feeling a little patronized. I don't have a good segue, though.
I don't either.
I was hoping I'd find something about swimming or water related.
Well, we have Dr. Paul Silke here to do his own segue, and he actually came to this building to do his research before even attempting to create this fantastic event that we had last summer.
Yeah, so we want to talk about your background and how you came to a story, but jumping off of that.
Yeah.
Not, let's get not, to the lead not jumping first. Into the river yet, but yeah, jumping off of that.
Diving in.
Ooh, yes.
See, I knew it.
So better at this than I am. So you did mention, and before you come up with this idea and you want to put it into regatta, but I love that you went and did research about it first before you just say, hey, why don't we do this? So talk about the motivation behind that and what kind of research you found. And
sure. No, it's appropriate. This is a very historical event. And the motivation was probably threefold. Number one, any swimmer that I've met in the last few years who have come across the river, it's like a mountaineer. They see a peak and they want to climb it. It's hard to not look out at the river and have a swimming background and go, hey, I want to cross that river. I'd love to swim that. And so I've met a handful of people, more than a handful of people, who had that very same sentiment. It's the very same sentiment that I experienced in February of 2023 when I came here for the very first time. Interestingly, the day I got here, there was a boat stolen out of the Astoria Harbor.
Oh, right. Yes. That was the day you got here.
And subsequently saw the footage of a rescue swimmer going in. He didn't quite go all the way across, but very impressive swimming and made a nice rescue. Boat didn't do so well. So number one is just the challenge of crossing the Columbia. Number two, the fact is that it has been done. It's been done repeatedly. There's some legends about how it's been accomplished. But more importantly, there's some well-documented history that in 1934, the Astoria Regatta was looking for a way to liven up the regatta. I guess it had dropped off in import over the several years. So I think it was Bill Seaborg who was in charge of the athletic committee for the regatta. He went out and recruited two swimmers. They happened to be Cannon Beach lifeguards. These were young men under 20 who had actually made fame because they swam out to Old Tilly.
Oh, wow.
And so they had made the Seaside newspaper for swimming out to Old Tilly a few weeks before the regatta. And so Bill recruited these two gentlemen to be part of the regatta swim. They called it the Trans-Columbia Crossing at that point. And they dumped him in. They dove in off the old Megler Bridge, ferry bridge, and ended up swimming. They got into the water about 10 o'clock, and they made it into 35th Street about 5 hours later. Now, there's some controversy if you look at the different descriptions, but it sounds about right. So they really got pushed upriver and did the crossing. That was 1934. Fast forward 90 years, our regatta, it was a resurrection, if you will, of the swim across the Columbia. And then, you know, the other event, my day job is as an emergency physician. I'm the medical director at Columbia Memorial Hospital for the emergency department. And we have an expansion project. And I thought, well, let's harness the energy of these people who want to swim across Columbia, make it a charity event, and see if we can't get a twofer. So the timing of 90 years since the initial swim, the purpose, the why of doing it for a good cause for the community, rebuilding or expanding Columbia Memorial Hospital, and facing up the challenge, felt like the right trifecta.
So I have a million questions, but first you should be applauded because I love bringing something back that people have forgotten about. And I think there are a lot of us that would never consider swimming across, but we're fascinated by the river. Maybe we don't have a boat, but we go past the river every day. We look at it, and somehow we just seem a little removed from it. So anyway, we can get more involved with the river. I like that. But one of the questions I have is, what is the best spot? And what goes into choosing the spot and the time of day? You know, what kind of a tide do you want and what helps? So give me some of the logistics in terms of either for the event or just when you do it on your own.
Well, I think we're trying to keep your listeners awake. And I can dive into these tactical details pretty deep. But in summary, we did quite a bit of research and drilling training exercises to understand how the swim would go based on the tides. And what we came up with is we had a great entry point at Napton Cove, which has its own historical value. And I got to, you know, thank the folks out at Napton Cove for letting us use their beach, based on the fact that it was the main port of entry for the Pacific Northwest for many years. They had built up a nice quarantine station, a beautiful wharf, and the beach was a great place to start the swim. And then we had tested the tides. You don't want to fight the tide at any point. And from as the crow flies from Napton Cove to the Maritime Museum, again, also historical, is 5.1 miles. We studied the tide and we said, well, if we start as the tide is flooding coming up, we'll get pushed up river a little bit. And then as the tide ebbs, we'll be pushed down a little bit. And for the most part, it worked very well, maybe too well. Most of us overshot the Maritime Museum at the finish. In fact, I ended up all the way down at the West Basin. So I got to cross underneath the bridge. But most folks ended up along the riverfront and touched out. And then we had our safety teams swing those people back up to the Maritime Wharf. So it was really about getting the tides. The weather was also important. We didn't want a low-lying fog because we were going by line of sight. And obviously, as you were talking about the tombstone studying, lightning would be a bad thing.
Yes, it would. So I've been fascinated. Never heard any mention in any of the articles I read, and I've not gone back to do any of the historical research on this. But it seems like Tongue Point would be a good spot to either aim for or to start from and go the other direction, just because it saves you in theory, doesn't it? A little bit of the length.
We considered that.
Okay.
It felt appropriate for the regatta to start in Washington and end in Astoria. So that was number one. And given that it was the regatta and most of that, many of the activities are focused right downtown, we wanted to stay with that theme. So ending at the wharf at the Columbia River Maritime Museum felt also like an important feat. We did talk about Tongue Point, and we did also speak to or considered a point-to-point swim that is from Tongue Point to the Maritime Museum, but we really wanted to cross it. Now, logistically, doing an open water swim like that, there are very few relatively large open water swims because there's a lot of safety concerns when you spread out a bunch of people, you know, across a 5 mile plus course. And when we were originally looking for partners, most of them said, yeah, we don't want to get involved with 5 miles across the Columbia River. So, you know, and you made a point, you know, I've only lived here about 18 months now, but, you know, there is a appropriate level of intimidation that the Columbia brings. It's, you know, it's the graveyard of the Pacific. And really the river has been used pragmatically. It's involved with logging and fishing, and many of the longtime locals are respectful of that use of the Columbia River. And there's not a huge aquatics community here. There is some. And, you know, since starting this whole attempt to cross the river and then completing it, we've formed our own Masters Swimming Club, which is adult swim team, more or less. And so there is, I'm hoping that not only does the swim help Columbia Memorial Hospital, we've already seen it benefit the regatta. There was a lot of excitement around that. But I'm really hoping to motivate swimmers of all ilk, particularly the kids. I'd love to see the kids get involved with competitive swimming. And, you know, to have the goal of doing an open water swim across the Columbia, I think is a nice thing to put on the wall and try to achieve.
I love it. My 9-year-old was, she was all for it.
Oh my goodness.
Oh yeah, of course. She was like, how do I get to do that? I'm like, well, let's, you
about
know.
20 years, Carly, 20
let's
years.
Start a little smaller. So talk about that, Dr. Silka. So how did you become an open water swimmer? And also, when did you find this passion for swimming?
Yeah. So I was put on swim team to get me out of the house when I was a kid. it's a great secret for you parents out there. And then, you know, I had a bit of a stuttering swim career, some age group, some high school, some college. But what really stuck is in 1980, I became a Los Angeles County ocean lifeguard. And if you've ever seen the show Baywatch, Baywatch is based on our lifeguard service. And it's not quite as dramatic. And
you don't run like that?
We do sometimes, but we actually try not to run because we all work together and we're all backing each other up. And if you see a fellow lifeguard running, you got to get going. So we're very thoughtful about when we actually put it into overdrive. But you know, some of the show, much of the show represented, it was filmed on our beaches. It was actually started and produced by a friend of mine who is a real lifeguard, wow. Greg Bonin. So that's that background. But as a ocean lifeguard, it is really built on staying in shape and watching the water. And we have competition year round, really gets hot and heavy during the summer. And from surf rescue swims to paddle swims, paddleboard races to open water swims, that was much more fun than as a competitor than swimming in just the pool. Pool's great. Open water swimming is amazing. And, you know, subsequently I've done, you know, a lot of open water swims and it's really a nice way to, it's very zen-like. So the older you become, the more relaxation you can get out of it.
So aside from here, what have been some of the other unique places that you've swum?
Well, up and down the California coast. And probably my most memorable trip was to St. Kitts. The country of Nevis and St. Kitts is divided by two islands, and the swim starts on Nevis, and you go about 2.5 miles to St. Kitts across the open ocean, and it's a lot of fun.
So what distance, and it's probably, I know, 100 different things, temperature and currents and things like that, but just for any standard open water swim that you're doing, where is it beyond the Zen and now it's just a hike? Or it's too short, I didn't even get the feel of the water. What's that sweet spot for you? What kind of distance do you like?
Mac, that's a great question. It's a little bit like a run, right? Marathon's too much. 10 miles is okay. So in swimming, I'd say a mile, for an open water distance swimmer, that kind of gets your motor going. In swimming, 6.2 miles, that is considered a marathon swim. So anything 6.2 or longer. And in fact, if you look at the Olympics, that is the marathon swim is a 10K. Right in there is a sweet spot, anywhere in that distance. Now, upriver, they do have the bridges swim where through Portland, they swim across or under all the bridges in the Willamette. I think it's 11 bridges. Didn't get a chance to do that this year. I'm new to the Pacific Northwest. It's on my bucket list, but we were getting ready for this little swim. So, but it gives you an example. That one's about 11 miles, as I recall, 11 bridges, 11 miles, somewhere in there. I'm sure your listeners will correct me on a text message. But it is going downriver, so that it's you're going downriver, so it takes the edge off of that.
So I do want to talk about how you got here and how you got recruited and what drew you here. But one more question: you said up and down the coast, so I've got to ask: have you ever done the Alcatraz?
My youngest daughter and I did Alcatraz in 22.
So, to tie into history here, did the three guys make it or not? What do you think?
I'm an optimist, and the swim's actually not that bad. I just don't know how three guys who had no opportunity to train could do that swim at night. Doesn't compute for me.
Even with bad blow up life preservers?
Yeah, I don't think so. Okay. I don't think so.
And they wouldn't have been able to take into account weather and tides, right? I mean, it was just timing.
Right.
So the timing worked and they had to do it.
We got
to
go now.
Right.
So. Yeah. But the one guy, the last guy did make it like in 64 or something. And that's why they decided, okay, maybe these three guys could have done it, because the one guy did, but he was exhausted.
Right.
And Disney like barely make it. And...
Yeah.
But anyway. Okay. So how'd you get recruited? How'd you end up in Astoria?
So trained as an emergency physician at LA County USC Medical Center. Did my residency there. I grew up in Los Angeles. And I practiced for 22 years exclusively at Cedars-Sinai in LA. After that, I did some... started to do some more business-related healthcare, always practicing in the emergency department. Meanwhile, our kids grew up, got out of the house, and we were ready to move on from Southern California. Beautiful place. Don't hate me for being from there.
We don't.
It was time to move on. Our middle daughter is a veterinarian physician in Lake Oswego. Came up here and discovered Oregon. So I checked with colleagues and I found out Columbia Memorial Hospital needed an old ER doc. and so it was a match.
And they couldn't find him, so they found
I know, right. So when you came here, I mean, was this your first time to Astoria? Because it is quite stunning. And what were you thinking, especially with your swim background, with water kind of everywhere?
We had scoped out a little bit of Oregon, fell in love with the coast. So when my OHSU buddy said, hey, we've got an opportunity out there, we were very excited. Getting here and seeing it exceeded expectations beyond belief.
I love it. See, how can we doubt anyone from Southern California when
that's right.
What they say?
So I just want to know how fast, when you saw the river, did it go through your mind, I got to swim across that?
Seconds.
So then when did you do it? And how often do you swim?
So I've only gone across the river the one time. It's
okay.
It's logistically a challenge, but routinely I will do a workout swim, either leaving from Pier 39 or from the wharf at the Maritime Museum, and just check the tides, and I'll go against the tide, a mile and come back. And you can do that comfortably without a wetsuit, in July and August. So the, those are the times to do that.
And how often have bystanders shouted at you, do you need help? Or how often has the sheriff's water rescue team showed up or anything like that?
So the first June 23 swim I did, I jumped in off the, I had a wetsuit on and I jumped in off Pier 39 and swam downriver. I don't remember where I got out at that time. And I guess there's a Facebook Riverwalk group.
Yes.
And apparently there was a lot of chatter. Now, I don't have any social media per se, but it immediately got back to me and I just kept my mouth shut.
Nope. You're like, nope, that was me.
I got an alibi. I was somewhere
else. They probably were concerned, if anything. I mean, it's all in good taste.
So what do you love? I feel like we should have done like 3 hours with you instead of just 20 minutes. But what do you love about your job? I mean, what emergency room versus you could have a quiet practice somewhere, I assume, versus an emergency. So what appeals to you about that?
You know, it kind of goes back to the beginning of our talk. You know, becoming an ocean lifeguard, it is, especially in Los Angeles County, we are making rescues daily. We have lots of medical calls, trauma, medical calls. So that really kind of lit the fuse, if you will, to be in that first responder type position. And healthcare sounded like a good gig. So it was kind of a match to go directly into emergency medicine. And it was a burgeoning specialty. I actually had some advisors in medical school that said, don't go into emergency medicine. It hadn't become a primary board certification process yet. Now it is. Now we're recognized as one of the, you know, most exciting specialties. Now, it's hard work. All of healthcare is. But at the end of the day, you go out to the car and you've generally helped a few people.
So tell us, too, a little bit about the transition of going from LA County to here, because I mean, there you can run into your patients, but here you will run into your patients in the grocery store, in your sweats. I mean, it's going to happen. How has that been for you and for your family?
Yeah. I think there's about 4.5 million people in Oregon.
Yeah.
I used to pass 4.5 million people when I was driving to work every day. So, it's very different. One thing that I will say, you know, and I got to recognize my colleagues at Columbia Memorial. This is a really tough environment. All rural healthcare is challenging, as is urban. And I've seen both sides of the coin now, but we are under-resourced. We have the challenge of poor access and generally poor baseline health. So people are waiting a long time to show up. They show up, they're very sick. And those folks, my team is working their tail off and doing a really great job, not just in the emergency department, but throughout the hospital and all the clinics. So, but it is rewarding. And, I think this era is noteworthy because with our new facility, while we won't necessarily expand beds, we will expand for square footage, and we'll be able to offer more services, and I think just a better experience and higher quality healthcare as we go forward. And I completely forgot the question, but
well, you are part of all of it, and we're so grateful you're here. Thank you so much, Dr. Paul Silka, Columbia Memorial Hospital. Appreciate your time.
And we hope people just run into you in the water and not at the emergency room.
Yes, wave to him as he swims by.
Please do.
All right.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening. Go make some history. We will catch you next week.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.